With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
It is the Anfield Wrap Weekend. A great deal to come. We're looking at the Irish Festival. There's a Dead Pigeon Gallery exhibition at Home Baked. We'll be looking at that as well. Jane Lawless coming in for that. Emma Smith Irish Festival. Chris Waugh coming up on the Longstaff Brothers. We've got our own Longstaff, but I've been assured he is not related. But suddenly the world's full of Longstaffs. What are you going to do about it? But in front of me to look back on Jurgen Klopp's reign at Liverpool and look ahead, hopefully, to the sunny uplands of the future, I am joined by the impressive Adam Smith, the impish Joel Rabinovitz, and I have got the impresario himself, Ian Salmon. All are here in front of us for the Anfield Wraps Weekend of this week, so hope you've been looking forward to it. Whatever you're up to this weekend, we will hopefully set the weather for you in a positive way. And Ian Salmon, I remember when Jurgen Klopp came in, and I remember muttering darkly after a recording of a show to Rob Gutman saying these exact words, something on the lines of, all these bastards who are delighted he's here are going to soon be suffering when he has the same issues with the infrastructure around him. If anything, Klopp's greatest achievement has been not just what we've seen on the pitch, but also the absolute significance of the change off the pitch, which he's been a massive, massive part of.
Yeah, it is completely. He's changed the entire culture, the entire nature of the club. He's managed to change, I'll get onto Wormy High Horse in a second, but he's managed to change the mentality of a sizable majority of the fans. There's some people who still need to sort their heads out when things go against us for 30 seconds. But the way he's come in, and there was a very enlightening article by Tony Evans last week, I think it was for The Independent, about Brendan Rodgers just before coming back, obviously, with Leicester, which pointed out some of the issues that were going on off-field that we didn't know about. And I think Jurgen's desire and happiness to work with a sporting director and to work closely has been a major change in what we do. His manager has allowed himself to be persuaded on footballers that have turned out to be the greatest footballers that we've ever bought. You know, it's, we know the transfer committee were instrumental in persuading him to go for Mo, and that has obviously worked out quite well for us all. And he's the first person to admit that kind of thing. So it's that infrastructure, and also the fact that he does work closely with the owners. He's a manager who doesn't seem to fall out with the owners in any way that is visible. He seems to have a very good relationship with Mike Gordon, is it? Gordon. So he's built, after a period, I think we'll look back at, of about a decade of no real steadiness, he's built something that is genuinely likely to be a dynasty.
There's, for me, in his first season, his first half, part season, three quarters, two-thirds of a season, Joel, there's three standout moments now that sort of, that echo. The first one is the West Brom going to the crowd at the end of the match, taking the players to the Kop at the end of a 2-2 draw, which received ire from some quarters, including the aforementioned Tony Evans. There is the, I can say all that about Tony, I'm chatting to him next week, I'm interviewing him. There is the, also the, for me, the walkout, the Sunderland game, again another 2-2 draw, where the crowd walks out on 77 minutes against the price rises, and then there's the Dortmund 4-3. And I've always thought, I've long been of the view that if you're Klopp, you know, we always think appraisals go one way, but if you're Klopp, you're able to walk in the summer and say, can we have more of things like the Dortmund 4-3 and less of them walking out on me, please, and what do we need to do to fix this?
Yeah, I think those three are all massive. I think I'd add one more to that as well, which was the Palace game. I think it was a month before the West Brom.
Before West Brom, when he said he felt lonely.
Basically gave the crowd a bit of a bodying afterwards and said, yeah, I felt really alone in that moment. Everyone started leaving. I think we lost 2-1 on the day. And then that's why the West Brom one was so significant, because even though on the face of it, a 2-2 draw at home to West Brom is nothing to be celebrated as such, it wasn't a celebration. It was, you've helped us get over the line here. It was a 96th minute equaliser, I think, in the end.
Divock.
Yep. And so from that moment onwards, it's kind of been a gradual process of rebuilding Anfield into what it is now. 44 games unbeaten in the league, I think it is now. I think you can trace that all back to that West Brom game. The Dortmund one as well is massive, because I think you can make a strong argument that Man City, Roma, Barcelona, none of those nights happen if Dortmund doesn't happen the way it does. I think that was the first one where we really got to see what Klopp's team could do when the crowd is up like that. Because it was 2-0 after 9 minutes.
Yeah.
And we scored three times in the last 25 or half an hour or so. And in kind of the grand scheme of things, in terms of what we've achieved over the 4 years, that probably ranks quite lowly compared to what we've done since. But that was very much a starting point. And the fact that we didn't get over the line in the final was kind of neither here nor there, really, because we got to those two finals in his first kind of three quarters of a season. We weren't really expected to achieve anything. I think you can distill that whole kind of first season for Klopp down to a process of working out which players he wanted to keep moving forwards and what were going to be part of his plans, which ones he wanted to let go, which is why we saw the likes of Benteke and Sakho left. And in every season since then, it's been kind of an incremental process of adding more quality, keeping the players that we have got, and also making the ones that we did have better. So,
in terms of the off the field stuff, it was always interesting to me how he pulled his path through the Sunderland, the walkout conversation really, really cleverly. At no point did he criticise the ownership of the club, but at no point did he defend them. At no point did he defend the decision. At no point did he, in not signalling a side, he signalled a side, but he never got himself into any trouble. And I've always thought, I've long been sort of the view that if you're him, and it's very difficult to be Jurgen Klopp and to be pushing the agendas that we talk about there around the Palace game, the West Brom game, what to come, the Dortmund game, if people are walking out, if the core supporter sufficiently, I can't quite think of the right word really, because it wasn't as though there was a feeling of sort of disengagement. It was the opposite of anything, but there was that sort of, I think that if you're him, that gives you a hell of a lot to take to the ownership, take to the hierarchy of the club, to say, we've just got to be better at all this. I can only do so much with the footballers. You've got to keep these people happy along with me.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that Klopp's brought in general is the confidence of being somebody who's very good at what they do. Because I think Rodgers always had self-belief, but also I think he had a need to prove himself all the time.
Yeah.
And that dominated, I think, his management at the club, his handling of certain
biggest
players,
opportunity of his
everything.
Life. Exactly. And a defining opportunity. Not for the Klopp, Dortmund's the defining opportunity. Liverpool is the opportunity that you get after the
yes,
defining opportunity.
And where you can go one step further and you know, you can make yourself immortal and all those sorts of things. You know, that's what you could do at Liverpool. If we win the title under Klopp, he will go down with the big, I mean, he's already gone down with the biggest managers, but if we win the title, then he's better than all of the managers we've had since Kenny Dalglish. So, you know, he's better than all of them because he matches Benitez and goes one step further if we win the title. So he's got an incredible opportunity, but he's the sort of person that never needed to prove himself, but he had the footballing chops to mean that FSG never needed to question him. Whereas they did with Rodgers, but FSG also didn't necessarily have the confidence in themselves to be able to say to Rodgers, no, you need to work with a footballing director, no, you need to do this. And if they had, maybe his time at the club would have been a little bit more successful. But because neither of them were in charge, because they both sort of felt they were in charge, there was never a cohesion there. Whereas Klopp's happy to walk in and go, yeah, you do all the finance stuff, I don't care, you tell me who we can buy and I'll make it work, I'll figure out which of those players I can make work. You tell me what we can afford to do and I can figure out how to make it work. But I'm telling you that from a footballing point of view, you need to keep these people happy. And that being in the sort of situation where we're having walkouts, where we're having protests, we're having all that sort of stuff, that's not conducive to anybody. And what's it for? And he's able to do that with a confidence that FSG have to listen to him because he knows what he's talking about. And that kind of dual thing going on meant that they could respect him, but he respected them as well. And it never really felt like that was the case with Rodgers. You never, for even, you know, even ignoring all the Tony Evans stuff that's come out recently, you never really felt like there was mutual respect between the two sets, if you like. Whereas from the second Klopp came in, and he, you know, and again, he you're absolutely right with the walkout. He never took a side, but whenever he got the opportunity, he was praising the owners. He said how good they were, how brilliant they were, what a great job they were doing. Blah blah blah. He was always saying that sort of thing, but he was obviously behind the closed doors saying to them, listen, what's the point? What are you getting a couple of extra million? Just, is that really necessary? That's what it felt like, you know, that he just had that confidence.
If I remember rightly, the day of the walkout itself, knowing that the walkout was happening, wasn't it the day that Jürgen had an operation and was away from the club? So in terms of, you know, I wouldn't suggest that was deliberately tactical, but if it was deliberately tactical, it was a brilliant piece of tactics.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was fortuitous timing, because it meant that he didn't have to take any kind of stance or opinion in the ground at the time. And he wouldn't have anyway. He'd just carried on coaching, obviously.
Well, the next major milestone for me, and we'll split these either side of our guests, our callers, is the win against Middlesbrough, but also the way the manager handles himself immediately afterwards. So listen, you could pick Stoke in the 2-1 where he makes the double change at half time and Firmino scores that fabulous half volley. You could pick the Emre Can overhead kick against Watford. You could look at the early part of that season where Liverpool played some really, really good stuff that was exciting, but then they grounded out. But for me, it wasn't just the win against Middlesbrough. It was the fact that I think for the first time you felt like post-match he almost had a prepared speech, where he was, this is the minimum requirements. This is just the base for everything we do from now on. We should always be playing Champions League football.
Absolutely. I think that Middlesbrough one, and if I look back at all the games over the last 4 years, even though it was Middlesbrough, and they were already down at that point, weren't they,
yeah,
on the final day, in terms of what I was most nervous for, and because the stakes were so high and what rested on that game, that is still right up there, and I include all the finals we've been in that, because... And even all those games leading up to it, you mentioned the Watford one, West Ham away, which I know we won 4-0 or 4-1 in the end, but
yeah,
it was a nervy start. It took that Coutinho pass to set Sturridge through, and there was that horrible 1-0 against West Brom, was it, with a Firmino header?
Just on half time.
So it was a real kind of slog, because we didn't have Mane in that run-in as well, and he was so important throughout that season. But that Middlesbrough game, again, I remember watching the first half hour and we weren't playing well. I think Arsenal had already gone 2-0 up quite early in their game. So when they put the actual current table up, we were not in the top four. And there was also a Lovren penalty incident where I think it was Bamford, which could quite easily have been given. And then the timing of that Wijnaldum goal right before half time was huge. And it ended up being a bit of a procession in the end. But I think in terms of everything that's followed since then, you can kind of... there's a chain that starts. Obviously, we had to get through the qualifier against Hoffenheim, but I think if we don't have Champions League football on offer, you almost certainly don't get Salah to leave Roma to join Liverpool. And then what happens with the next season, getting to Kiev, probably doesn't happen. And then you can build it on from there. Fabinho, Alisson, Van Dijk, all of these depended on us getting Champions League.
There's a Roy Evans quote, Ian, which is that Liverpool without European football is like a banquet without fine wine. I think that you can now... and should always say it's Champions League football, whether that's right or wrong. That's the reality of the way in which the world works. And that, you know, I'd go back to last season on this when, you know, people, including me, up to a point where we're thinking the manager would have to choose between league and European success, that was something that was going to be in front of him at some stage. He rejected that, and I think he rejected it because he understands that the very fabric of the club needed to display what it's about on the European stage if it's going to succeed on the domestic.
Completely. He's completely off that line of Liverpool exists for winning trophies. He completely gets that, and it has to be at the highest level. We brought in players who's, you know, we know that our ambition is to win the league. We want the league desperately, but we've brought in European players who want the European Cup. So the only sensible solution is to go for both at all times. And he spent 3 years building a squad exactly to do for that. That's more like a proper English. But that's why he's built the squad. He's spent 3 years with a vision and he's built a squad. He's been given the time. He's demanded the time. He's deserved the time. And he's known from day one when he's come in what he's wanted in terms of building the shape and changing. And this is why we don't get any purchases in the summer. This is why he's so definite a manager, so focused on knowing exactly what he wants and exactly what he needs, that the idea of bringing in a Nicolas Pepe or a... Dybala or any one of the other players that nobody bought in the end at all, or bringing in Fekir, he knows what he wants and he is not going to do anything that's going to jeopardise the harmony of the team. And one of the other points, one of the other great milestones of his reign, one of the great early ones, which game was it where the glasses get broken? Norwich?
Yeah.
In the celebration?
5-4. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the first real indication for me of exactly how much harmony there is between manager and players, that celebration. I think that defines his entire reign with us, that he's built a squad of real harmony and built a squad that believes in him and believes that everything that he's going to ask them to do is the right thing to do.
16-17 now feels like a world ago, to be honest with you, Adam, for a variety of reasons, the way the players have moved and changed since then. I remember coming back from Burnley when we got beat 2-0 that season. I genuinely remember sort of coming through the door, and it's the last time this has happened. You know, the manager's got the line doubt us to believe us, but I walked through the door and Samantha said to me, "You just seem really down," and I said, "I just don't think he can do it. I'm just really worried he can't do it, that, you know, we're going to go through all this and he's not going to be able to do it." And it's forgotten, isn't it, really, that season, I think the year after when we have Salah in, yes, we end up having to complete top four on the final day, but you always felt like we were going to do it. That was a scrap. It was a scrap all the way through that campaign, and it was emotionally draining.
Yeah, I think that what we've seen is a kind of season by season progression, because the both of those seasons were one in which we needed to win on the last day of the season, wasn't it, to get top four. But the year before, I agree with Joel, you know, it felt a little bit more on edge. It just felt a little bit more...
We had about three chances to do it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, and just couldn't quite do it. And then that year, you know, it just felt a lot more like, well, we're going to do it. It's fine, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, a lot of people were panicked, weren't they, towards the end of the season.
That 1-0 defeat.
Yeah, things like that, where people were like, you know, God, well, why has it got to go to the... It's gone to the last day of the season again. It's ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. But I just sort of thought, well, we're going to win. It's not... It was never in doubt. Never a question for me, and that kind of belief had started to really seep through the support, as Ian says, the majority of the support base and everybody, and it's now kind of got to the point where it's solidified, to where you're kind of going into this season, most people saying it's us and City. You know, that's what it is. It doesn't... The only people I heard saying at the end of last season that Liverpool wouldn't be able to do it again this season were pundits and commentators. No, I didn't hear any Liverpool supporters, didn't read any of the supporters on Twitter, nothing. Nobody was saying Liverpool won't be at the same level again this season. Everybody kind of felt, we're good enough to do this. We're going to do, you know, we are a brilliant football team, and last year wasn't a flash in the pan. And it all stems from that kind of simmering sense of belief that's kind of filtered through season on season on season on season. And he did say doubt us to believers, and everyone loved it and it was great and blah, blah, blah. But that he said that on his first day at the club. We still had people walking out. We still had people huffing and puffing. We still had people, and we still had, exactly like you, people walking home and going, this might just be a little bit too big for him. But little by little by little by little, but we have got to the point where actually now it's when people don't believe, when you're at a match and you hear people moaning and crying, they stand out, because you're going, what are you doing that for? You know, they are the minority now, when it wasn't for so long.
Okay, this is the Anfield Raps Weekender show. We're going to do more of this to come. Also, we've got something on the Irish Festival with Emma Smith. A little bit of work at the home-baked Dead Pigeon Gallery thing coming together as well. That is to come. Jane Lawless for that. Always good to speak to Jane. And Chris Waugh talking about the Longstaff brothers from The Athletic. Don't go anywhere. Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons having a chat about Harry's. The Razor people are back, John, and they're always on edge.
What a pun that is. They can have that one, can't they?
They can take that one with them and see where we end up. Also, you know, the messaging is sharp.
Oh, I mean, you could take this kind of marketing to the bank.
I think this chat's smooth. Honestly, we can go for some time.
I thought you were keen to do this.
I was honestly, I've had a big morning thinking about Harry's when that just your brain's wearing away underneath.
This is what comes with Eternity, partnering with the Anfield app. Really good puns.
Yeah, an endless number of them. A supply coming absolutely all over the case. We very much enjoy partnering with Harry's. We have done for some time now, to be honest with you. And if you've been sort of listening to these messages and unsure sure when we do personally recommend, those recommendations are personal, which is the case for everything that we do these sorts of reads for, to be fair. But in this instance, on Harry's, we are very much into the idea of I still shave with Harry's. I very much like the aloe vera based shave gel that you get with it. That's my favourite part of the Harry's experience, John. I think you're more of a weighted ergonomic handle man yourself.
Well, I just love the science, do you know what I mean? I love it. I love the future. I love it. You know, I'm a progressive kind of guy. But you're right to point out that there is something new, and I think, you know, we've said to no to something this week. We say no to sort of quite a bit, but and anything we say yes to, we insist on getting sent them. Not just because we like freebies in the post, but because, you know, we want to check it's good, and we want to check that, you know, we will put our weight behind it, so to speak. If for what it is worth, we like Harry's, we like dealing with them, and we like the razors. So yeah, if you haven't tried it out yet, we would encourage you to do so. And yeah, it's cheap.
It's harrys.com/Anfield. You can get starting shaving with Harry's today by claiming that trial set for $3.95. It's harrys.com/Anfield. The story is interesting, and obviously it's interesting the way in which they work through the internet, taking less profits and selling directly via the internet, which obviously suits us. So we like this chat of internet-based businesses.
I'll never catch on.
Yeah, yeah, not that we're biased or anything. And the amazing quality blades are half the price of the leading five blade brand. All of that information is there. But more than anything else, really, they have supported a number of podcasts over a long period of time, and ours is most definitely amongst them. So it's harrys.com/Anfield. The trial set is $3.95. It gets you the razor handle, the five blade cartridge, the foam and shave gel, and the travel blade cover. Blade and shave there became something different in my mouth. That is what you need, and it is good. We wouldn't recommend it otherwise. Get stuck in. Joined by Emma Smith, the director of the Irish Festival, to have a chat about it this year. It starts on the 17th, formally on the 17th of October, but we're going to chat about something that runs before then that got my attention when I went through the programme in a minute or two. But Emma, first and foremost, what should people be looking for from the Irish Festival this year? It seems quite an interesting time politically to be doing something like the Irish Festival. I'm sure you've been engaging with that through the work.
Yeah, so this year the theme is actually unique stories creatively told. And through that lens, we can look at things politically, we can look at things historically and also fictionally. So there's loads of things that we can sort of draw people in on. And the way that we're still looking at that is that all of these stories collectively help to create the characteristics of Ireland and help shape that cultural identity. So we're looking for as many stories. We're telling stories, but we're also collecting stories throughout the festival. So people shouldn't be afraid to come up and let us know where they're from, what they've been doing, what their connection with Ireland is. And to make sure that we know about that, we're also looking for assistance in what people might like to see in future, because that all connects with storytelling and that rich tapestry that helps us understand Irishness.
You cover an unbelievable amount of ground across the 10 days. And as I say, we're going to have a little chat about something prior to it. But it is almost every genre of cultural enterprise gets covered, from theatre. You've got something terrific with John Connors that's going to appear. You've got, obviously, there's music in there as well. But there's the stand-up comedy. There's a sort of historical looks. There's family days. It's absolutely everything that anyone could need across the 10 days.
I'm nodding emphatically here. Yes. We're an arts and culture festival. That's absolutely our unique sort of selling point, really, is that we're not tied to one particular framework or mode of art. And the other thing is that when you start to look at Irish culture and how it celebrates itself expressively, it's very rarely one medium or another. It's nearly always music and dance, or music and dance and theatre, or poetry and prose. So it often has these sort of layers of mediums. So we've tried to echo that across the programme. And as you say, there's a really rich variety and diversity of programme, things that we could sort of draw your attention to that are maybe unusual and you don't see in other festivals.
Well, I mean, one of the ones that stuck out to me, because it would, is the Indie Cork Film Festival, looks like a remarkably engaging platform for emerging filmmakers, and is really you're working with them. It is this sort of dark green. It's a program of Irish horror shorts, which the screenshots in the brochure and on the website really grab your attention.
Yeah, I mean, Indie Cork, we've worked with forever, such a long time, and what's interesting about working with them is because they've got such a large cohort of artists who send them work each year, is it works as a kind of barometer for what filmmakers are thinking about, what the kind of current discourse is. And Ireland hasn't got a huge history of horror filmmaking, but actually that the use of that as a genre to express current thinking seems to have picked up a lot in the last few years. I'd also tie to that the Celtic Animation Film Festival, which happens the same day just ahead of that, and again is a series of shorts, but instead of being film, it's animation. So anybody looking at what's happening in filmmaking now, I think, should look at both of those events.
And also, you're remarkably brave about being outside throughout this. There's a couple of tours. There's a South Liverpool walk. There's a history tour about Liverpool and its history. There's even a New Leaf, which is being done in the bombed out church, which counts as outside as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, right.
You're very, very bold about getting people wet.
Well, I think the thing is that...
I mean, it's very Irish getting people wet.
It's very Flann O'Brien, I was going to say. No, I think those tours are really exciting for people, and they show the absolute impact and influence of Irish people and communities on the shape of the city. And something that an artist, Paola Bernardelli, said last year when she visited was that if you visit the Liverpool Irish Festival, you visit all of Liverpool, because it gives you a sense of the city and how that connects with that history. I know that people might get wet. It could be glorious. You just never know. And Brian Acton at the Bombed Out Church, I think, is going to be amazing.
Well, I mean, just on that as well, that's obviously it's a compelling children's story.
Yeah.
It's on the 19th of October, just to give people information on that one. It's very much about bringing children along to that one. And there's a couple of others that work like that as well. It's timed around half terms and things like that. So you've very much got that in mind with the festival.
We're really creating a family trail through the festival. So there's a number of things that people could pick up on through that, including the family day and the family Kaylee. But yeah, I think Brian's A New Leaf is going to be really spectacular.
There's stuff already happening. There's In the Window with Rory Shearer at the Blue Coat, and the stuff that's starting pretty soon. And this is a series of a really interesting sort of strand of work within the festival, is the Invisible Women series. And it's starting in the Tate. It's starting at the Tate next week on Monday. So it's from the 14th of October. And it is something which you're trying to... For instance, each day's got a different theme, a different approach. Monday's dual heritage. Wednesday is people trying to deal with mass trauma creatively. Thursday and Friday is about Ireland reaching out. It's a really bold, open door sort of approach. This, you very much want people to come to you as part of, and this is both part of the festival formally, but not a formal part of the festival proper. It's a really interesting sort of way of separating this out. I mean, it must wreck your head a little bit of time as the director.
Occasionally. So Invisible Women started as a trail through the festival 3 years ago, because we were looking at this misnomer of Irish society being a matriarchal society. And of course, like all societies, it's not. It's both. At least it's both, if it's not patriarchal. So we were just trying to figure out ways in which we could talk to other members of the Irish community who weren't necessarily being seen through the creative arts. So, for instance, if you take traditional Irish music, regularly it's more male-dominated than women-dominated, because the women danced.
Yeah.
So we were trying to look at other ways of getting women involved through Irish creativity. So what we've done is expand that. We spoke to Tate about becoming a Tate associate, which we managed to do. And that gave us a week within their space, Tate Exchange, to run Invisible Women. And as a result of that, we started looking at things that would be important for women to discuss. Not that men can't at all. Everybody is very welcome. But it was a space in which we could talk about things like, as you say, dual heritage and what that means and how people are treated here for having Irish dual heritage. We could look at things like the Two Iron Graves, for which Clara Kerr has produced this incredible choreographed piece called Caltier, which we're really looking forward to seeing in that space against the backdrop of the Mersey, looking out towards Ireland. So there's all of these incredible things where we need to sort of look at what Irishness means to people, what it does when you're in a different location, so what it means to Liverpool and how that affects people. And we're sort of helping people talk about that and think about that, and then think about identity and whether or not they are finding equity today.
The identity question is absolutely fascinating, always is to me. It's this, there's the, for instance, the very idea of dual heritage. There's an openness about the idea that identity is a multifaceted thing. And I think that's something which the festival's always trying to pull through one way or another. But it, within this instance, you know, identifying, people identifying as obviously as women, how that in different heritage senses kicks in, how that then reflects into today. And what I think is really interesting about the Invisible Women Week is that it's almost four or five different flavours of that conversation. It's not one overarching one, and it's not one dominant one from the from a lecture down. Monday does have two or three lectures on, but from that point it then becomes much, much, much more conversational, and every day is open.
The first one isn't lectures, they're sessions in which we're asking people to come and talk about specific things. So the first one is a lecture. It's about the race riots, because we've used the race riots that are a century old this year to talk about the term miscegenation, mm-hmm. which has become an incredibly negative term about being of mixed heritage. So there is one session that sets up that idea of what dual heritageism is in Liverpool, because there are some very specific groups that we can look to start thinking about dual heritageism. So for instance, one of those is Black and Irish, which is not the same as Black Irish. So if you're Black and Irish, what we're sort of referring to in that terminology is being probably of Afro-Caribbean descent and having other heritage too. But there's also Irish and Chinese, and many others. But the thing about Black Irish is, if you Google that, you will end up with white people with black hair and blue eyes.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are discussions to be had about what even those dual heritage terms mean and say. So we're sort of looking to explore that. But yeah, one lecture, and then the others are sort of story release sessions where we're asking people to come to us and tell us about their heritage.
It's an important part of the work, which is that the work doesn't, your job and the idea of what the Irish Festival is, it doesn't just stop in this 10 days. And that's a really, really important point, is that what you get from these, and you want people to come to these, it's really important. People come, they're at the Tate, people can just come in. What you want is you want people to come to these, but then that sort of informs the work that goes on across the rest of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the other things that we're doing down there is collecting those stories. We're going to try and document as many of those as we can. We're asking people to give them to us and contact details so that we can explore those further in future year programming. We're thinking that next year's theme will probably be exchange, but this is an exchange of stories. And so actually anything that we learn this year, we can start linking through year to year so that we can help extend those stories and understand them over a longer period of time, and sort of, I don't know, I suppose just generally expand what we know about Irish culture in Liverpool.
All of this, so the Tate stuff is all free. So I'll just reiterate the dates again for people who are listening. So it starts on the 14th of October, 10 till 5 every single day from the 14th, and it runs through until the 20th. That's at the Tate. The other thing to point out as well is that everything right the way through the festival itself is all, I'll say, very, very, very keenly priced. There is something here where, you know, you're very... Nothing is expensive, is what I'm saying. Absolutely nothing is expensive. Every single thing that you've got running, it's either free, maybe occasionally with a registration, or with the idea that it all looks to me to be very, very, everything's under £15.
I think there's one at 20, but you get three incredible acts and an amazing host for that.
Excellent. I'm always annoyed when the host isn't me, but we'll move on. we'll not take that personally. It is all in there, isn't it? And I think quite deliberately tried to, you know, for instance, there's Kilkelly who are playing as well. You know, everything that's on there is really engaged, and also it reaches out to the rest of the city. So for instance, the Kilkenny stuff is in conjunction with Mellowtone. You very much try to keep this festival, I said before, not just sort of geographically across the city, but working with as many different other groups within the city as possible.
Well, I think the thing is the Liverpool Irish Festival is exactly that. It's the Liverpool Irish Festival. And so there's this idea of import and export. We can't just bring Ireland here. We have it here. And so we try and use what we have and connect that with outside Ireland stories too.
Okay. Everything is on the website. The website is theliverpoolirishfestival.com. I'm hoping next week we're going to be chatting to John Connors about his play, Ireland's Call, which I'm really looking forward to having that conversation with him and working from there on. But there's absolutely everything that you might need across the set from the 17th / 14th right the way through until the 27th / eternity at liverpoolirishfestival.com. You want a little look through there. There shouldn't be anything that you're missing out on. Let us know what you fancy, and if you go to anything, let us know at the Anfield Wrap and let the Irish Festival know as well.
And I'm now joined over the line by Jane Lawless, who is the artist and also a curator of Dead Pigeon, the Dead Pigeon Gallery. Jane, thank you so much for joining us on the line.
Hello. Hi, Lizzie.
I've got you at the moment up the wall. You've just been on a booze run to Aldi.
Oh my God, yeah.
Because you're setting up an amazing little exhibition in a much well-loved, well-thought-of place in Liverpool, which a lot of our listeners and subscribers will know very well, which is right next door to Home Bake the Bakery. And the reason I wanted to get you on, Jane, is because you were heavily involved in Home Baked and setting it up. But also, I mean, I sort of come across this and I noticed something that probably a lot of people don't really understand, is that there's something a bit bigger to Home Baked called the Home Baked Community Land Trust. And that's, the Home Baked Community Land Trust owns that strip of houses, which everyone will know, which is like that little row to the left of Home Baked. They're all derelict, but you're taking over one of the semi-derelict ones and you're putting on an art exhibition this weekend.
That's right, yeah. Well, I can tell you a little bit about the difference between the Community Land Trust and the bakery itself. So initially, back in 2011, when this whole project... And when I'm talking about that project, it was before it was known as Home Baked, it was obviously Mitchell's Bakery,
yes,
which everyone remembers and has stories about. And there was an artist called Jana who came over. She was actually initially hired by the Biennial to do something in the local area with local people. And she insisted on being here for 4 years so she could actually get to know the community rather than one of these kinds of parachuted art projects. Because she recognised the sensitivity of the area and that a lot of us were in the process of losing our houses, including myself. So anyone who goes to the match especially will remember there was like almost 20-year period where all the streets were tinned up. And if you came from there and you lived in that, it was awful because you were literally living in a ghost town. So this artist, Jana, she came over and she realised that you couldn't just do a quick fix. So she approached Mitchell, the bakery, who at the time was still owned by Mitchell's and run by Mitchell's. And they were struggling because, well, if you take away the houses and the community, who's going to buy the cakes? Mm. So she kind of like intercepted and said, well, what if we, as in me, an artist, rent the space off you, as in your bakery, Mitchell's, and we'll just open every Tuesday night and see what happens? So literally... the light came on Mitchell's Bakery every Tuesday night. And over the course of a year, people started dropping by, going, what are you doing and what's going on? And that's how it all began. So she realised that people were so at a loss because they were losing, you know, the area that they grew up in, and they didn't know where to turn, they didn't know what to do. So Jana decided, with the project money that she had and whatever, and her clothes, because she's an international artist, she said, well, what if I introduce you to people who can tell you about community land trusts and how you go about actively saving the land together? And we were like, really? And she said, yeah, and we can introduce you to architects and we'll just get from there. So basically, while we're there, being introduced to all these things we've never heard of, because nobody thought we had any power, because nobody wants to believe that you've got any power, we realised that we also had this opportunity here to stick together as a group and make something positive out of something unbelievably negative that was happening to us. And we just said, we're sick and tired as a community of this all being done to us, and we've got no control, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So basically, while all this was happening, people started knocking at the bakery and saying, are you doing pies again? Are you doing bread? And by now, the kind of bakery side of it as well and truly lapsed, just because there was, you know, there wasn't any passing trades. So we just thought, well, what should we do here? And that's how the actual bakery element was formed, and that became Home Baked the Bakery, which almost was acted as like a front window. But meanwhile, there's always something happening in the background, isn't there, in any project. And that thing that was underpinning everything was Home Baked Community Land Trust. So two separate boards set up at the same time, the bakery itself as a self-sufficient business. And then if you see the CLT almost like the mothership, so the bakery is in effect a tenant of the CLT. I'm sorry, I've just whispered on for ages there.
<It's fine. laughs> So the CLT, like you say, is the sort of bigger picture of it all, isn't it, if you want to call it that. So they, and like I say, you will know the houses. I knew it exactly as soon as you said to me off air which row of houses they were. And you know what? I had to look at the house that you're doing this exhibition in the other week when I went to match, because it caught my eye, because I walked past the Sandon. I walked past the Sandon on my way to the match. I come up past the Sandon wall in the garage, Home Bakes on my left, and I saw that the house had something going on, and I was dead intrigued. And probably a lot of people who go to the match were like wondering what was going on. And I just saw this and I thought, I think it'd be wonderful to tell our subscribers, our listeners, about the stuff that you're doing. And the CLT obviously own that property, and you're going in there and using that space, and you're basically putting on an art exhibition till Monday.
Yeah, well, just to clarify something, the CLT own the land.
Sorry, yes.
But now not the property.
Yeah.
Just because we just have to like make sure that everyone understands that.
Yeah.
So they've secured the land, and the next process is to get the houses redeveloped, and then ultimately the goal is that they'll eventually come into ownership of Home Baked.
Yes.
But basically, from our perspective, as in me and my best mate, Catherine, we set up Red Pigeon Gallery about 2 years ago, because we just got like, I suppose we know loads of people with loads of talents, and we were like, unless you like the big guns and you're going to get into the Walker or the Tate or even like the Blue Coat, you know what I mean? You can't really show or demonstrate or what you actually do or what you're passionate about. So we set up the Pigeon Gallery, literally it was a fluke name, because we worked with a guy called Jason Abbott, who owned a then semi-derelict warehouse off the back of London Road. And before this was going to get redeveloped, he said, well, do you just want to do something with this space? Ultimately, it's a bit of a shithole, but it's going to be amazing. But nobody else is going to touch it with a barge pole right now. So we walked in, big old warehouse, and it was literally full of dead pigeons. So we just said, there's a nickname, ha, Dead Pigeon Gallery. And then straight away, everyone just started saying, when does it open? Nobody even questioned the name.
Because
I sound a hipster, don't I? So we just thought, well, because we've come through all this process of getting cursed out by developers, in this sense, we felt like we were cursing the birds out. So we decided to keep the name and almost take the bird as our talisman, because we were like, we're so sorry that the arrival of us means you lose your home, because that's happened to us so many times.
Yeah.
So we decided, I literally had birds died in front of me, and I just thought, right, I'm going to sketch you as you do. And it was that sketch that the whole thing just grew out of that. And then when we had to leave, because they were redeveloping it, and then we couldn't afford the space, the usual story, I just thought, well, the gallery doesn't have to die. We can just approach other people with buildings and say, can you host our gallery for X amount of time, and we'll bring an exhibition in and blah blah blah. And that was 2 years ago, and this will be our fifth location. The one before this was actually a fire department station in Texas that I took over for 3 months. Now that was an adventure, because I even had a Black Widow spider turn up to that.
Oh no, thank you.
And all the techs and all the texts of firemen and women were just like, yeah, man, the Dead Pigeon Gallery, that's cool.
But no, it was boss. This one I've seen online, someone said it's come full circle. And do you feel like that? Because obviously what you've just told us there about Home Baked CLT, Home Baked the Bakery, that's quite a while ago now, and now it's sort of like, you're back after something started, like you said, a little bit small, very community-based, has now become quite a wide thing, which a lot of people have took under its wing, excuse the pun. You must feel incredibly proud to be going back there to host your exhibition there.
No, it's lovely. And I think we always wanted to, because I used to be on the board of the Community Land Trust, and just personal reasons, like my mum got sick and then we lost her and we had to step down from the board, then my dad was on it. So it's always, we've never really strayed too far away. But I knew that when I came back to home base, I wanted it to be in my own capacity as, yeah, I'm a local and I'm a season ticket holder, but I'm also an artist and I'm proud of that. And I also want to encourage other artists, especially from working class areas, where there's still a stigma to putting your hands up and saying, you know what, I'm into art and I do it, or poetry or music, or I can play the ukulele, or we all tend to skiss each other when we're working class artists. And I'm like, well, why? We need all the forms of communication possible, especially now. You know, don't want to go political, but under this Tory government, blah, 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 blah. We need to really celebrate what we can all do together. So our motto, like as in Dead Pigeon Gallery, is definitely to celebrate and highlight the strength and the creative might, not only in home base, because that's what this show's all about, but especially in working class communities, because what we found as working class artists is the only people who can take up the opportunities are rich people, because most of the opportunities you've got to do for free. I'm going to step down off my soapbox now, Liz.
Listen, you're making things happen and you're providing a space, and, you know, with Dead Pigeon Gallery as well, you're encouraging it, so it's only a good thing. And like I say, I know it's probably quite short news, as we're speaking now on Thursday, which is the launch night. This show goes out Friday morning. But for anyone who's listening, who's around and about, you know, it doesn't all just come to a halt on after a match day. The whole community doesn't close down. There's still amazing things going on that people can get involved with. Home Bake still runs, by the way, every day of the week, basically. I've been down there myself and I see like loads of workies going in there and stuff like that, and I just wanted to sort of give it a bit of a shout. And of course Mr. John Gibbons is playing his trumpet down there, isn't he?
Yeah, because he played for us, him and Chris, and Fire and Fleet. They played for us back in the day when we literally didn't even have an oven in the bakery, and we never forgot that. And the Anfield Rap were one of our biggest like supporters and champions, and they just started the Anfield Rap. I think it was around 2011-12, and we just started in the bakery, and it was like the two projects were really kind of a fledgling, and I think we loved watching them go from strength to strength, and I think Anfield Rap have enjoyed watching Home Bake go from strength to strength, so it's nice to get John back for that reason as well.
Well, Jane, good luck for this week, and not that you'll need it, I'm sure it'll be absolutely brilliant, and everything that you're doing with Dead Pigeon, and just keeping, you know, the Anfield alive and still bringing this sense of community, and I think is wonderful, and something that we should all try and actively be doing more so ourselves, the places we live, or even Anfield, because we all hold it so close to our hearts. So so thank you so much for joining us on the Weekender.
So it's John Gibbons for the Weekender, and we're doing the last fan standing quiz again. I hope you played last week. I hope you got involved. I hope you enjoyed me and Neil doing the presenting on Last Fan Standing. We did the Friday quiz on the app, and we also did the match predictor. There was 8 winners of the match predictor, so hopefully one of you new players won that. But we are playing again. We're playing a quiz from the last week, and on the phone, we've got Liam Fairclough. Liam, hiya.
Yeah, all right, John.
Nice to speak to you, mate. And are you confident on this? What's your LFC knowledge like? Because I know you're a young lad.
No, it's all right, like, but... Yeah.
Well, it's mostly stuff in your lifetime. I say that, actually. I've just looked at the third question, and it's from 1990, so I'm just lying to you. But anyway, the lad last week only got one, though, so you've got one to beat. So I think you can do better than that.
Well, I should hope so.
So the way last fan standing works is, and we're going to play it. So you download it on your app, and whoever's playing that night at 7 p.m, you keep going until you get one wrong. So we're going to do the same as well. So there's 8 questions, but as soon as you get one wrong, you're out. And then how it works on obviously the app is if you get all 8 right, then you're sort of the last fan standing. But we're just going to sort of go on that. So first up, it's just a yes or no. Is Virgil van Dijk the current captain of the Netherlands?
Yes.
He is, correct. We're off, Liam. Good lad. okay, number 2. Who did the Reds buy midfielder Charlie Adam from? Was it Stoke City or Blackpool?
Blackpool.
Correct. 2, flying. Number 3, John Aldridge represented which country in the 1990 World Cup in Italy? Was it England, Scotland or the Republic of Ireland?
Ireland.
It was Ireland. Irish listeners were screaming out on that. Yeah, he played for them in 1990 and 1994. And there's obviously famous footage of him telling the linesman, I think it was, to fuck off when we couldn't get on. That was in the boiling hot heat in Italy. But yeah, he was at 90 as well, according to this. Okay, slightly tougher one, this. Which of these Liverpool players is the oldest? So Adam Lallana, Dejan Lovren or Jadon Sancho? So which of those players is the oldest? Lallana, Lovren or Sancho?
Lovren.
No, it's Adam Lallana. He's 31. Lallana is 31. But Free, you're top of the leaderboard so far, Liam.
It's right, yes, it sounds good.
And we'll send you a t-shirt. We'll get you a t-shirt out in the post as well.
Also, all right, nice one.
And before you go, international breaks are crap, aren't they?
Oh,
this is
fucking
off.
I don't know what to do myself.
I mean, we'll watch something. I mean, Brazil and Senegal are playing right now. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon.
Man, he's got a penalty,
you know,
scored, didn't he?
So the Reds are doing the business at the moment. But yeah, no Liverpool to watch this weekend. But Old Trafford next week. Are you confident coming to Old Trafford?
You never know, you know, because like the derby, its form just blows out the window sometimes, isn't it? So I hope so anyway. But yeah, hopefully a 4-0.
That'll be good. I'm just conscious we were crap there last year, so I'm hoping we put up a better performance. Yeah. Sam, anyway, Liam, nice one. You're on 3 points, so you're the top of the leaderboard at the moment. So, but we'll keep playing it. So if you want to play, do look out on the Facebook subscribers group. We'll be putting that out probably later than we should be, kind of each Thursday, kind of looking for players. But if you've enjoyed this, if this is a bit of you, you can download the Last Fan Standing app. It's completely free. There's a game every night at 7 o'clock, and then 3 hours before each Liverpool game, there's a bit of a predictor one, which you can win cash prizes. Me and Neil are going to be hosting a few of them, so look out for that. But in the meantime, nice one to Liam for playing, and back to the studio. And it's John Gibbons again for the weekend, and now delighted to be joined on the phone by Chris Waugh from The Athletic to talk to us about an article that sort of pleased me greatly, Chris, you wrote earlier in the week. It's about the Longstaff brothers. It goes into, you know, in depth sort of into their background and just sort of what it might do for kind of the feeling around Newcastle and United. You know, you don't want to, you know, pin too much on a 19-year-old lad, I suppose. But, I mean, first of all, these two brothers, you know, how they play the game, and obviously the fact that the story around a winning goal in front of the Gallagher, you know, against a big team, is, it does sort of feel like the story that Newcastle United fans needed at the moment.
Oh, definitely. This has really boosted a city. I cannot tell you how different Tyneside feels this week compared to last week. Last week, after the 5-0 hammering at Leicester, there was deserved criticism all over the place. Steve Bruce had got things wrong. The players had been terrible. And I think that there was almost a fatalism on Tyneside that, look, we're going down this season, and that was horrendous. But then on Sunday, Bruce made some very bold calls. He made significant changes, no more so than bringing 19-year-old Matty Longstaff in for his Premier League debut alongside his 21-year-old brother, Sean, who's only played 13 or 14 Premier League games himself. It was a significant risk, but it really paid off. And yeah, you don't want to place too much on these young lads too soon, particularly Matty, who's only played 90 minutes of Premier League football, but he just brought something different to the Newcastle side, the way that he played it. He had a fearlessness about him. He drove them forward. There was energy in midfield. It was everything that Newcastle were lacking the week before. And for it to be two lads who grew up in North Shields, have been Newcastle fans for a lot of years, for him to score in front of the Gallagher to win against Man United, his dad, David Longstaff, who is a ice hockey, but still ice hockey coach and player at Whitley Warriors, for him to be there, it was a really, really special afternoon on Tyneside. And as I say, it's transformed the mood.
Yeah, you mentioned the article that his dad was meant to be playing, wasn't he? And had to sort of, you know, book an afternoon off work. I mean, I'm better glad he did. You know, he'd have been gutted, wouldn't he, if he would have missed that?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah, his dad's in his 40s now, and I think that he scored a goal a few weeks ago for Whitley Warriors, the ice hockey team, which made it 30 consecutive seasons he scored in, which unreal. I think is a record. But so he coaches them, but he had thought about going along to play on Sunday. I think Matty persuaded him and said, look, Dad, how many times are you going to get me to see me make my Newcastle United debut? And so he went along, and yeah, I think he had a good few drinks in the corporate box and really enjoyed himself. And yeah, it was a special afternoon for his family, and what I would say about the two of them is, and I know there was the tweet from Gary Neville the other day about the interview after the game on Sky Sports, where the two of them, about 3.5 minutes, it's just sort of unfiltered joy, and you don't get that very often from footballers, but the two of them are just still young lads who've grown up in Newcastle, desperate to play for this club, and it really was brilliant to see, and they're both genuine lads, they're both very down to earth, their family keep them down to earth, and they won't get too high from all of this. I mean, undoubtedly they would have expected all of the scrutiny that there's been this week, not in a negative sense, sorry, all of the coverage that's been this week, but really they will be embracing this as well, and they'll be thinking, this is only the start, we want to keep going here, and hopefully in time Newcastle have found two young lads who can really help them. That actually this season have already had four academy graduates, Paul Dummett, Andy Carroll, who's now back, and the Longstaff brothers play for them in the first team in Newcastle, and it's a good few years since Newcastle have had that, so that's a real positive as well.
I'm interested to get a bit of background about Matty and how much sort of buzz there's been around the city about him, because sometimes with a young player, you know, people will be talking about them, you know, from sort of 15, 16, oh, he's going to play in the first team, watch out for this kid type thing. And then sometimes a lad just gets an opportunity and just takes it. I'm wondering which kind of one Matty fits into more.
Well, Matty's an interesting one because behind the scenes over the last few years, between Matty and Sean, I think Sean that they're almost saw more of an attacking midfielder, and I think they were concerned in terms of could he transform into that sort of deep line role he was going to play in, and he broke into the team and did very well as that. Sean was brought into the setup by Rafa Benitez in the summer of 2018. He worked with the first team for the whole first half of last season, then eventually got his chance due to injuries. Matty really only broke into the under 23 setup at the start of last season. He was probably the most consistent player, to be fair, and there's a lot of people behind the scenes who said for a while, if you pick one of the two Longstaff brothers, I'd probably say Matty's more likely to make it. But that's not that they were thinking this guy's definitely going to play for the first team. Yeah. He's got something about him, he's got energy, gets around the pitch, but he's not the biggest, he's not the flashiest, and so he wasn't someone who I think at the age of 14 or 15 everyone thought he's definitely going to make it in the first team. But through hard work, through perseverance, through learning from his brother, through the upbringing that he's had, and his father and mother, who's a netball player herself, keeping them grounded, I think that they've just kept working at it, and he really impressed. But as soon as Bruce came in the summer, I was out in China, Matty Longstaff was already there, and he said first training session I saw him, and he said because he was ginger he could notice him a lot more than others but in general he said he just saw him, and week on week he said it was getting to the point where he basically couldn't ignore him any longer, and once what happened at Leicester happened, he decided he wanted greater legs and mobility in midfield. He brought Matty in.
Do you think what's happened with Matty might give Sean a bit of a boost as well? I read probably in your article that it was his best performance of the season. I mean, the start of the season hasn't gone brilliantly for him, I think it's fair to say, and I know there's you know, he's had injuries and stuff, but there's maybe a bit of talk that the you know, rumours around him leaving, you know, the bids on Manchester United and things like that might have been a bit of a distraction. Do you think having his brother there alongside him and everything that's kind of come through that might give him a bit of a boost and improve his form a little bit?
Undoubtedly, I think that you saw that in his performance on Sunday. I think having his brother alongside him energised him. It was almost like, I want this to be a brilliant day for Matty as well. We can feed off each other. And they haven't played together loads. They did a fair bit first half of last season in the under-23s when Sean kept on going down, then come back with the first team setup. But really, Sean so far this season, he had a knee injury in March, which was the first serious injury he's had, I think, in pre-season. He was surprised himself how long it took him to come back. Behind the scenes, some of the coaches, I think, have commented privately that he was almost overthinking when he was, say, if he got the ball and he was turned from one side to another, rather than being a natural motion as it was last year, he's almost overthinking it. He wasn't subconsciously trusting his knee yet. Then he picked up an ankle injury, just a small one in training, that set him back again. And he hasn't been himself so far this season. He hasn't reached the heights of last season, partly, I think, because he set the bar so high, partly because he admitted himself a few weeks ago there probably was a little bit of being distracted in the summer when his name's being mentioned every week with a potential £50 million move to Manchester United. But he's knuckled down, he's focused, and Matty coming in there, yeah, it has energised them. I think they're both really fed off each other on Sunday. When one of them made a good pass, they were applauding each other. When they were in trouble, they were coming to help each other. So I think the two of them, they really did complement each other well. And look, we don't want to get carried away here, but I just think that the two of them in there at the moment, I can't see, with Isaac Hayden still being suspended, I can't see how you wouldn't start the two of them at Stamford Bridge in Newcastle's next game.
And to go back to the early point about it, it's sort of been a nice boost for fans as well. It's great to see two lads who, as you say, seem so grounded. What I really like about the piece is it gives a lot of colour around them as young men as well as footballers, and the fact that they've still got a season to get to the local club. As you say in there, they'll play a bit of cricket. I mean, they probably won't be allowed now, I would say. You don't want fast bowlers running in at them, you're certainly into the season. But they just seem like good lads, and that's nice for football fans as well, because obviously we've got someone like Trent Alexander-Arnold who's a wonderful footballer, but also someone who a lot of us in Liverpool look up to, and you know the kind of person he is, and the fact that he just insists, look, I'm a normal lad who's living everyone's dreams, and I'll appreciate that. And fans like that, don't they? You want to see someone, you want to see a young lad make it from your city, but you also, it means that much more if you can tell that they realize how special it is, and it means as much to them as it would do you if you somehow found yourself in a Liverpool or Newcastle shirt.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's so many similarities between that Liverpool and Newcastle in terms of what it means for someone in either of those areas, respective areas, to grow up and play for their clubs. And you can see that in both Sean and Matty. They've been massive football fans their whole life. They've played ice hockey as youngsters. They played cricket as well. Sean was a very good bowler. They started out in North Shields Juniors. They still go there every week. They've got a passion for that area of Tyneside. And they just love the fact that they are now playing for the boyhood club. The fans really buying that. Newcastle fans, when they went through a period where there weren't many first-teamers who were from the area, Paul Dummett aside, it was spoken about every week about how it was ridiculous that Newcastle couldn't bring through players. How was there no one from this footballing area who could get into the first team? And there was almost that disconnect. And given everything that's going on negatively at Newcastle United at the moment, the disconnect with the owner, the disappointment with Rafa Benitez leaving in the summer, the underwhelming appointment of Steve Bruce, to have A, Sean Longstaff last season, but B, his brother to come in alongside him last Sunday to score on his debut alongside his brother in midfield. It's just, it has really lifted the city, and it feels, week on week, Newcastle is a very, very moody city in terms of it changes dramatically, and this week just feels markedly different to last week, and it feels, for the first time in a long while since the summer, that there is a little bit of positivity going forward.
And I guess it's just a case now of keeping that feel-good feeling going, because Newcastle, they're still 16th, aren't they? So they come out of the relegation zone, which is, always good, always feels good. But, I guess it can't be forgotten that this season's still going to be a battle for Newcastle, kind of whatever happens, really.
Well, without doubt. I mean, Newcastle's biggest problem is that they seem to have a lack of goals on the side. They've only scored 5 Premier League goals so far this season. Even last weekend against a poor Man United team in a game that Newcastle, particularly in the second half, got the better of them in, they didn't have too many clear-cut chances. I think Alan Saint-Maximin coming back makes a difference to them, because he gives them a direct running ability. They need Miguel Almirón on to get a goal, because he looks desperately short of confidence. Joe Linton's not really a central striker, and it's trying to get as much as you can out of him, while also get Andy Carroll and try and get more minutes out of him. But it will be a struggle this season. I think defensively, when he plays with the 3-man central defence, as he did at the weekend and as they did away at Spurs, that for Newcastle suits them best, because it sort of covers their own limitations and they're almost stronger as a unit. But between now and the end of the season, they're going to have to find a greater source of goals, whether that's getting Dwight Gayle fit again, whether that's hopefully Saint-Maximin and Almirón contributing, because it is going to be a struggle. And if you offered a lot of Newcastle fans 17th, 16th place now, I think they would take it, because I think that they realise that even after the positivity of last Sunday, this is a team who have yet to find consistency and that does lack goals.
And just finally, on The Athletic and the fact that obviously you're given the room to kind of write this kind of thing for The Athletic, must be sort of part of the reason why you took it up, because a lot of this information, in the article is stuff that you've been building up over time, really. So it's not a case of, we need to research for a piece I'm writing today. I mean, presumably this is this is talking to, you know, getting to know the family over a period, you know, sitting on the fact that Sean once took 6 wickets. Isn't something you can necessarily build an article around? Well, maybe you can, but you know, it's that information, isn't it? And it's collating it over the time, and that's why, you know, we know James Pearce well, and James is really good at that. Really, he'll be writing a story, you know, that he's not quite sure what it is, but the information is kind of gathering all the time, and that's what sort of, I mean, I would say good journalism is really. It's kind of, you know, it's preparing for the story that maybe one day you won't write, but hopefully you will.
Yeah, definitely that. It's about sort of gaining as much information as possible, getting closer to people, hiving little bits off, thinking, right, that's interesting, keeping records of different bits and bobs, getting to know people. And yeah, so one of the reasons I was attracted to The Athletic is it is about this sort of more in-depth, more time to do things. So you have the time to research, you have the time to do that, where it may not be a story now, it may not be a story even for months, if not years, that you may use something. But being given the time to really go frontline in depth and do that, and then when the time comes, you feel you can really build an article which has depth to it, which has different layers. And the long shots, actually, it was interesting because my idea going in to Sunday for the game, I thought, was I'll probably do something based on Sean Longstaff. Even though I knew Matty was playing, I was thinking at this point, if I focus on Sean, I've got a lot of information about Sean. Obviously, it being against Man United, the club we was linked to in the summer, I'd spoken to a few people in and around him the week beforehand, and they'd said how there seemed to still be a little bit of interest from Manchester United. So I was thinking about Sean, and then it sort of, during the game itself, after about 10 minutes, I thought, no, this has to be on the two of them together, the two of them playing. It's almost unique that you would have not just two brothers playing the same team, but two brothers playing together in midfield. I can't think of an example of that really anywhere in the last 5 or 10 years where that happened. And so it became a piece where I felt I had enough background information to really go big on that. And I would say that ours, where it was different to elsewhere, I'd say a lot of other people focused on Matty, which I fully understand, but I felt like our piece was a bit of both, which gave it a sort of different little perspective, which is hopefully what you're seeing, that hopefully we can bring on The Athletic.
Okay, The Athletic is a subscription service, a bit like The Anfield Wrap. We believe the quality is worth paying for. You can give it a trial, or you can sign up for a year. Obviously, if you sign up for a year, you get it cheaper, and there's a special offer if you go through The Anfield Wrap link, which is theathletic.co.uk/TheAnfieldWrap, and you can get The Athletic for $2.49 a month if you sign up for the year, so that is half price. It's a really good service. I'm really enjoying it, not just for the Liverpool stuff, which is predominantly written by James Pearce and Si Hughes, and is as good as you would imagine from those guys, but also the stuff I'm able to dip into from other clubs, and Chris's article this week is a really good example of that. So I hope you've enjoyed that conversation. If you have and you want to read more, it is theathletic.co.uk/TheAnfieldWrap to sign up. But yeah, thanks a lot, Chris, and it's good to hear about some positivity in Newcastle.
Yeah, so it's nice to be able to report on positivity. Unfortunately, have much of that recently.
Oh, we'll see how long it lasts. Cheers, Chris, and back to probably Neil.
Welcome back. It is the weekend, or it is the end of our show, but you know there's still another 10 or 15 minutes left. If you listen every single week, there isn't a game to look forward to, but there is Jurgen Klopp's tenure to look back on and begin to anticipate where it goes next. Joined by Adam Smith, Ian Salmon, and Liverpool.com's Joel Rabinovitz. Always good to have Joel on the show with us. He wrote an excellent piece actually about the West Brom walkout this week. If you do want to check that out, it is on the website there for you. It's Liverpool.com for that. Want to work through this, the sudden shift, and I think it's fascinating, Joel, the sort of the difference that Salah and then Van Dijk make in two quite different ways, I think, quite quickly, and also the sale of Coutinho in amongst all of that. It's, to me, the manager, you know, the manager seems to be pushing for Coutinho to go in the summer, and it seemed counterproductive. He was desperate to get Van Dijk in, wasn't going to move on anything else. These are the sorts of things that at times it felt he was at odds with a fair few supporters who would have hung on to Coutinho at all costs and were, you know, and just wanted any centre-back. And the backdrop of all this is Mo Salah, and I think the manager, when he sees enough of Salah, almost decides that he can decide that Mo Salah is Liverpool's best player and not Phil Coutinho.
It's funny when you look back at the squad now, and a lot of the players that are now kind of widely considered, if not Liverpool legends, some of the best players we've seen in our lifetimes, when they first arrived, weren't kind of universally greeted with that much excitement or kind of conviction by fans. Mane was one of them. I think a lot of us were kind of a little bit unsure about what he was going to bring.
A little bit underwhelmed. You were thinking Mario Götze, et cetera, et cetera. Exactly. Names were getting popped about.
And he was kind of talked about as a streaky forward who kind of had patches of good form and then went off the boil for 2 or 3 months at a time. Salah, again, his numbers were good in Italy, but obviously didn't work out for him first time in the Premier League. And I think he started obviously brilliantly for Liverpool, but throughout those first few months, you were always wondering, how is this kind of just a purple patch? Is this just a really kind of hot streak and he's starting well and he's going to fade off? And I think when I look back on that first season, I think the one that I really felt like he's going to do something special here was Stoke away, when I think he started on the bench. We started with Solanke up front that day, and I think he came on in about the last 15 minutes, scored that brilliant volley and then scored again. And I think that took him to about 18 goals by kind of early December. And I was thinking, oh my word, because when he first came in, I was thinking if he hits 10 or 15 goals and gets a few assists, that's probably decent for first season. So for him to kind of hit almost 20 by kind of early December was kind of a real marker. And you're right, the whole Van Dijk saga, I suppose, was kind of going on in the background there, because obviously he missed out in the summer. And there was kind of rumours that we might go back for him in January. And I think one of the interesting things about that time is that although obviously the impact Van Dijk has is incredible and he's taken us to a whole another level, that Tottenham 4-1, our defence actually improved from that day before Van Dijk got there. In fact, the period from that game in October to December, we kept a lot of clean sheets, barely conceded any goals. And the actual structure of the defence was much improved, even though the personnel were the same. Lovren was still playing after that game. And then we had the Burnley one. I think Van Dijk had just signed, but he wasn't in the squad. Clavan gets a 94th minute winner, and then Coutinho goes straight after that. So that's a real crossroads if you're kind of mapping out Klopp's tenure so far. That whole kind of period of a few months, Salah kind of catching fire straight away, and then Van Dijk arriving, and
he gets a good hand in a few different ways, a bit more than I think people think. You know, I think Liverpool's experimental phase of its transfer committee had maybe sort of worked itself through. Michael Edwards was making more and more decisions at the club, and the players that he has and the moments that he has, you know, he gets a better hand than people think, but he doesn't half play it brilliantly. And I think that that's, in terms of the way he works around recruitment, lesser men possibly would have buckled and thought, I've just got to get a centre back in. They'd have just thought, not the one that I'm absolutely desperate for, and the one who's completely committed to us. Lesser men would have compromised once it couldn't happen against Southampton, and he doesn't. And lesser would also have thought, I've got to hang on to Coutinho at all costs. It feels as though the board will back me in that regard. They'll fight for all of this sort of stuff. And he doesn't do that either. He backs this idea that he only wants people who want to be there. But I think he also backs the idea, and I think it's really interesting. I haven't seen what's happened to Coutinho since, even though he's doing well at the moment at Bayern. I think he backs the idea that he wants his best players to be his front three, that it must be these front three. And if we do that and we get that right, I'm not messing about with this lad in midfield. We will go forward because we've got this dynamism. And that's what I mean when I say he plays his hand absolutely brilliantly.
He absolutely does. And I think you're right in so much as I think he gets a help not only in kind of, as you say, the committee having worked itself out and things, but I think he also gets a bit of a hand in the sense that a lot of players are better than people think they are. I think Dejan Lovren is a perfect example of that. He is absolutely not a perfect defender. We know he's got flaws and we know what those flaws are, but he's a hell of a lot better than some people think he is. You'd think from some people he can't even do up his boots. Like, you know,
you start for Manchester City right now.
Exactly. Right now we would, absolutely. If you said to City, you know, take one of our, you know, players off the bench, take any of the ones you want, they'd probably take him.
Lovren or Otamendi.
Well, yeah, exactly. So
you can make a strong case he'd start for virtually any side in the league apart from Liverpool right now.
Just at the moment, absolutely. And so there are things where it's that age-old thing. I think Paul Cope talks about it quite a lot, doesn't he, where he says about, you know, you forget that you watch these players all the time. You don't watch the same thing of other teams. And if you watched other teams, you go, bloody hell, as if Lovren's not better than, exactly as Joel says, most of the defenders in the league, yeah.
But when Joel said that, I actually got really excited about the idea of watching Luiz and Lovren playing the same back four. Like, wow. Like, I tell you what, they're keeping some dynamic clean sheets one week, but then they're shipping six the next.
Exactly. But and that's what you get. But Klopp had these players to work with, and he was able to sit back and go, yeah, there are some good players in there. I can get more out of these. You know, look, he would never say it, but he's going to look at it and go, I'm a better manager than Brendan Rodgers. I'm a better man manager than Brendan Rodgers. I can get more out of these players than Brendan Rodgers was able to get. So I'm going to lift this club immediately by 5 points just by working with these players and getting them to do what I want them to do. That's not to say he hasn't got flaws. I think pretty much everybody would agree that maybe he was loyal to subpar goalkeepers for too long. But I think one thing we don't know, one thing that is always kind of an unspoken thing behind the scenes, isn't it, is what information the manager's got.
Because when we're all panicking and going, get any defender, sign Johnny Evans, the manager's going, I know Virgil van Dijk's going to sign for us. We didn't know that. We, in fact, like 2 days before he was going to sign, Man City are talking about how, you know, there's that tweet, isn't there, of, you know, he's going to sign as a, initially as a backup to Otamendi or whatever it is. We're all panicked thinking he's going to go to City. Klopp might be sitting there going, I absolutely know we're signing him. We've just got to wait till January. And I'm willing to wait till January. If he didn't have that information, I'm sure he would have signed Johnny Evans or signed somebody else.
Or signed Laporte.
Or signed Laporte, exactly. But he's got information that we don't have that gives him the ability to go, no, I trust these lads. I trust Lovren to be able to do the job that I need him to do until January, when Virgil van Dijk's going to arrive. And when that happens, we'll be golden.
It's that January is the start of where we are now, Ian. And I think that when you sort of chart this stuff through, there's some unlikely results in there, but one of the core ones that defines the rest of that campaign and goes on to define the reality that both clubs have lived through since is Liverpool 4, Manchester City 3. It's a game where, for instance, Van Dijk doesn't even play, doesn't even feature. You know, Coutinho's gone, there's no Van Dijk on the pitch. It's worth remembering that day. And when Klopp does talk about the fact that it has been a team effort to get Liverpool all the way to Madrid, it's things like this I think he's referring to. But Liverpool that day, Manchester City turn up, they've already got the league won. They look absolutely imperious. No team in the country has looked like they've been able to land a glove on them. And then Liverpool basically decimate them and say to Manchester City, this is what you're up against now. And you're going to possibly win more than you lose, but you're not going to win them all.
Yeah, and it was I'm trying to remember back to the performance now. Was that just after the League Cup final or was that the season?
No, it was the game after we beat Everton in the Merseyside derby, the third round of the FA Cup game. So it was pretty close to that. It was mid-January. So it felt like a night game, but it was a 4:30 kickoff on a Sunday, and that's one of the reasons why it ends up feeling as tumultuous as it does.
Yeah, because it feels like a European game, doesn't it? It's and also going back to the previous, that first season when we lose to City in the League Cup. But then they come to us, I think, the Wednesday after.
We went 3-0.
And we teach them what we can actually do. So I think everything is rooted earlier. But that that period at the beginning of that January, you see the change in the team. And I think it's a belief that if you give it to a load of players that here's this central defender, he's the most expensive central defender the world's ever seen. Everybody wants him. Real Madrid want him. Barcelona want him. City want him. He's coming to us because he believes in what we're doing. You give that to the other 10 lads in the team, the other 10 lads in the team know that they're quite good. And it's like Adam was saying about the players that are better than you think. Klopp comes in the first season, goes, who have I got? Right, okay, my lieutenant on the pitch is Adam Lallana. Adam Lallana is now going to be the key to how we play initially, because he will lead the press for me, because he understands what I want. He likes intelligent players with a bit of skill. And if you want an intelligent player, Virgil van Dijk is possibly one of the most intelligent players in world football at the moment. He just understands the entire nature of the game. So at that point, we start. I can't say we start transforming, because I think this is an endless transformation. I think we've also, one of Klopp's keys, as well as knowing what he's got, is knowing, as you said, not knowing what we don't know, but also knowing what we don't know for 5 years down the line. So when people are going, why haven't you bought this, and this? He's going, well, I've bought Hover and I've bought Van den Berg, and I've got Harvey Elliott, and I've got Rian Brewster. So he knows what the next 5 years of Liverpool look like. He's got a longer term vision than any of us actually watching the game have.
That the 4-3 and then the 5-1 across the two legs, I think, Joel, what it does is it sets the scene for the year and a bit that have followed up to this point. This idea that it tells Liverpool the story, that it tells those players the story. It's not a conversation about whether or not you're as good as them. You are as good as them. There's proof that you're as good as them. In fact, you're better than them. You've beaten them on these occasions. It's saying that we need to get all the other stuff right, all the other stuff that goes on, you know. And it's not the nature of the victories. It wasn't the Danny Murphy, Gerard Houllier smashing grab at Old Trafford. It was, you know, in the 4-0, the 4-3 and the 3-0, outplayed them, and then outplayed them in the second half of the Etihad. I think all of that acts as a springboard to Liverpool as they are now in terms of belief.
I think so. What's interesting about especially the Champions League tie, the way we went 3-0 up and then held out so well at Anfield from 3-0 up, and then when City got the early goal at the Etihad and we defended, we were holding on, clinging on for dear life at points there. But I think that kind of showed, as much as Liverpool, everybody knew that we could score goals and attack, that there was the bones of a really solid defensive team. And you saw that actually put in place for the whole of that 2018-19 season, which is what ultimately allowed us to compete with them in the title race. And I think what's really interesting now, if you look back at last season and the progression where we became a much more controlled, probably slightly more defensive oriented team than we were beforehand, there was more balance, to where we are now, where we seem to sort of, we're not keeping as many clean sheets, but we seem to have combined all the components of the previous 4 years into one sort of, I don't know, super team basically. It's all the best elements of Klopp's Liverpool so far in this current team. And I think that's what you see. We've arrived at this point where he's accumulated all of his experience and what has worked and what hasn't worked from his 4 years so far. And we're seeing that put into practice every week at the moment. And I think one thing that occurred to me when we were speaking there, in terms of progression and what lies ahead for the future, I remember reading, there's a chapter in Soccernomics, I don't know if you read the book.
Yeah.
And there's a whole chapter on basically, it's a study of what makes the most successful teams in history successful. And one of the most consistent factors is continuity and keeping a core group of players together. And it feels like for the first time probably in my lifetime really watching Liverpool, we've kept a core of mostly, if not world class, among the best in their position in the world together for, this is about their third year, most of them.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're now seeing, is despite the lack of transfers, you're seeing that continuity is leading to where we are now.
I think it's also his vision of what a player can be rather than what a player is, because the players he's brought in are players that City probably wouldn't look at. Obviously, Fabinho, we know City looked at, and he was very closely linked to them. So Fabinho comes in, everybody looks at him the first game, goes, he's probably not going to make it in the Premier League. And he turns out within 3 games being an absolute Rolls Royce for a player and so influential on what we do. I think he's an absolutely majestic footballer. But most managers at the very top level aren't throwing an 18-year-old kid in at right back and going, yeah, you can do the job, or buying a lad who's just been relegated with Hull for left back, or buying Gini Wijnaldum and saying, yeah, you're number 10, do you know what, my player's centre back every so often. and you can definitely do the holding role, but you're going to do this role that I've invented. Or take Bobby Firmino and go, do you know what, we're gonna create a whole new position in football just for you.
Or play James Milner at left back for a whole season.
Yeah, yeah. And make it work. And so he's got this vision of what a player can actually contribute to the whole. So he's seeing the entirety. And this is one of the things I was saying after the first half of the Leipzig game. The vision and intelligence of this football team is unparalleled at the moment. After the second half was a different matter altogether, but the vision of what the team can do itself is unreal.
There's a flip side to that though, Adam, as you begin to sort of look ahead, and we'll sort of round this up now because I think this is a conversation that can go on into next week, but there is a mild concern in that because this is such a big season for these players, you know, you look at the age range of players Liverpool have used so far this season in terms of minutes on the pitch, it's around 27.6. The league average is about 26. The only players he's used under the age of 25 are Joe Gomez, sparingly so far, and Trent Alexander-Arnold in terms of both league and Champions League. No one else has had a sniff. And there is a tiny little thing here where, rightly, this isn't a criticism, but he's almost got to ride these lads out through this season. And then we may well be having a tiny little bit of a transitional conversation in that you can't just keep going back to the well with the same lads over and over and over again. And it's difficult for them because there's so much on the line in every game to do pathways for Elliot, for Brewster, for, and he hasn't even got that many players aged between 21 and 24. This is very much a 25 to 29 squad.
It is. I think there is something, it'll be interesting to have that conversation again post-Christmas, you know, maybe sort of February time and where we're at, because I think he's basically seen Pep Guardiola's City side win the league by December and go, well, that's what, I'd quite like that. And, you know, that's what we're going to have to do to compete with City. As it happens, we've been, I'm not going to say fortunate, but we've had the good luck of City dropping enough points to mean that we've built up a decent chunk of a lead already. But if we get to January, say, and we're still 8 points ahead of them or around that kind of region, well, then he has got the ability to say, I'll put in Brewster. Because you know the thing that I was most interested by is in the summer, all the noise is coming out of the club where we don't need a forward, Brewster's been going to be the one that's going to be used, and we've not seen him at all. He's basically fell off the face of the earth as far as this season's concerned, apart from doing all the really great social media videos and stuff. He's not in the team, he's not in the squad, but I bet you he will be in January. I bet you if we're around there, because at the moment he's kind of going, I need these players, the ones who know what we're doing, know how to get us over the line, I need them to just keep putting wins on the board, put them on the board, and then we see where we are. And in January we'll have a little bit more, if things go as he wants them to go, where we've kind of done a City and steamrolled everybody and we're, you know, 8 points clear in January, February time, he's got the ability then to go, I'm going to use one or two of the younger players. Not loads of them, not all the time, not, but I'll have them on the bench. I'll put Brewster on for the last 10 minutes. Or if Lovren's ill, Gomez has picked up another muscle injury, well, I'm not going to be overly panicked about having to use Keanu Hoover, for example. So it'll be interesting, but obviously you're right. At the moment, he has got his players, and sometimes people get disappointed when the team sheet's there and it's Fabinho, Henderson and Wijnaldum again, or Milner and Wijnaldum or whatever, and people go, oh God, they, you know, blah, blah, blah. But Klopp knows what he's getting from them, and he knows that they will deliver what he wants them to deliver, and that, obviously, is key to his idea of success.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Right the way through the show, Adam, Ian and Joel also. Thank you very much to John, Jane, Emma and to Chris. It's been your weekend of this week. Whatever you're doing, enjoy it. Podcast Network.